I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book is described as a radical analysis of our master and slave relationship to energy, and it also calls for change when it comes to our dependence on oil. The book is called The Energy of Slaves, Oil and the New Servitude. Its author, Andrew Nikiforuk, joins me now, and I'll ask him to tell us about the premise of the book and how he uniquely looks at our dependence to oil. We'll also discuss how he sees our future and whether we will do better, whatever better is. Andrew Nikiforuk is an award-winning journalist and the author of many critically acclaimed and best-selling books. His book Tar Sands won the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award, and his book on Wiebo Ludwig, Saboteurs, won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction. The book is published by Greystone in partnership with the David Suzuki Foundation. His website is at andrewnikiforuk.com. Joining me from here in Vancouver today, please welcome to the Plant Online program, Andrew Nikiforuk. Mr. Nikiforuk, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you use slavery in terms of describing our dependence on oil. There's a figure in the book, how many, like in terms of how we use oil and how, it doesn't necessarily mean when we're driving, if we drive, it just means, because everything, I'm talking to you on a telephone into a computer, and that's obviously powered by energy as well.
Well, everything in our culture is embedded with oil.
Yeah.
I mean, oil is a dominant form of energy, followed by coal and by natural gas, and so 85% of all of the energy we use comes from hydrocarbons. And so this makes us, of course, a slave to fuel prices and gasoline prices.
Right.
But more importantly, it also makes, I mean, what do we use these hydrocarbons for? Well, we use them largely to power what I call energy slaves, and it's really not my term. It's a term that Buckminster Fuller came up with in Fortune magazine in 1940, and he was trying to define why the American experience was so exceptional and different. And he said it really boiled down to the fact that the United States had cheap oil and was feeding it at a rapid rate to all of these machines. And of course, these machines have now proliferated. And, the average North American has at their command every year from 24/7 approximately 89 inanimate or virtual slaves that come largely in oil's capacity to do work through machines. And that's on the basis of consuming an average of 24 barrels of oil a year per person. And this whole phenomenon is, I mean, it's really important, because what has happened here is that, one of our first experiences with energy and or an institution that energy institution was slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And we shackled human muscle to get work done, and those that were rich and powerful then used the surplus to lead very comfortable lives. And so many of our attitudes about energy and how careless we are and how abusive we are and how thoughtless we took from the institution of slavery and simply dropped that on to the petroleum age or hydrocarbon age, where we're using coal or natural gas or oil to power machines, to do work for us, to lead every increasingly more comfortable, dumbed-down lives, where we seem to all have the lifestyles of the rich and famous, or the lifestyles of slaveholders, in the sense that we are getting fatter, we're getting lazier, we don't know how to do as many things ourselves, we expect our machines to do everything for us, and we are going increasingly in debt to keep this whole complicated household together. That's fundamentally a moral and philosophical crisis that we don't even recognize as moral and philosophical. The ancients at least had some conversations about this. 18th century plantation owners in the United States actually had pretty profound discussions about slavery and the impact of slavery on the master. And they were in particular concerned about slavery provide them and what impact that would have on their children? Would it take away their incentives? Would it make them less competent? Would it make them frivolous in their attitudes and approach to the world? Unfortunately, we don't even have those kind of conversations anymore. And one of the reasons is that, you know, that if you go back and look at the history of ancient Rome or the history of ancient Greece, I mean, there was no abolition movement. Nobody questioned the dominant form of energy of the day. I mean, it was considered a ridiculous thought. You know, well, how can you get by without slaves? The same way today that whenever you raise or try to start a conversation about, well, how many energy slaves are you really entitled to? What fuel should you be using? And what exactly should you be using those slaves to do? What kind of heavy lifting should they actually be doing? And then how much of our own human vitality and human energy should we still be drawing upon? And whenever you raise those questions, wait a minute, Andrew, you can't, I mean, our economy depends on oil. Yeah. We can't have this conversation, which is, you know, exactly the same way the slaveholders approach the whole thing.
Yeah, you'll be putting a lot of people in the oil business out of work, so.
You know, which is the most privileged business in the world, and when on a per capita basis employs very, very few people. I mean, it's a capital-intensive industry. It's not a labor-intensive one.
Yeah. The premise of the book, I mean, is provocative. I mean, when you invoke slavery, as you have,
yeah.
What's the reaction been to it as you've traveled the country promoting this book?
Well, the reaction I've had so far is one of sober reflection and fascination.
Yeah.
And what I've found and what has surprised me is that people are now actually looking for new ideas. And most people get it immediately. I mean, the master-slave metaphor, they get. They actually feel that in their own lives. And this idea of imagining your household coming with 89 slaves is a powerful way to inform people about the scale of their energy consumption.
Indeed, yeah.
The other thing that I'm finding really interesting from people is that they get that these are moral issues. And they're saying, well, why haven't we had this moral discussion before? And they get that there are so many levels to this moral discussion. And I'm finding it's been a very interesting book tour so far. Just the depth of discussion I've had with nearly 1,000 people over a week, mm-hmm. and how hungry they are for different ways at looking at how we consume energy and abuse energy. And my book, I think, is really, in many respects, the book revives a lot of really important thinkers who have been dismissed or marginalized and who in their day actually were very well read. So people like Frederick Soddy, who was a nuclear scientist who was highly critical of our approach to economics, and said, look, you know, economics follows the law of physics and is really about energy flows. And when you change those energy flows and those energies become ever more expensive and they are primarily feeding energy slaves, then you can expect dramatic contractions in your economy. And he wrote in the 1920s and 1930s. And then you have people like, the Catholic theologian Ivan Illich, who wrote powerfully about the impact of owning too many energy slaves on a community, and how over time you would get locked into a system that would increasingly become more authoritarian and totalitarian. Then you have someone like Leopold Kohr, a great Viennese economist, who really talked about, one of our central problems is with a high energy spending culture is that we grow big things. We have big government, we have big corporations, we have big complex institutions. And Kohr saw this growth of bigness as being highly problematic. And said, look, you know, whenever anything really goes wrong, it's become too big. And that the solution in many cases is smallness and finding the right scale. And it's these thinkers and many others that I'm trying to draw people back to and say, look, these guys, had very powerful ideas that we now need to put back on the table again. Because when our current system, which is in crisis at this very point in time, and there's a global crisis, there's a national crisis here in Canada, and there is as well an individual crisis, and it's very similar on all levels. Much of it has to do with the rising cost of energy and growing debt loads right across the board, as well as the poisonous and corrosive politics of oil itself. And so in order to respond to these emergencies that are really going to challenge everyday life, and which Europeans and Americans and Japanese are now wrestling with, it's important to have these different ideas on the table, from these very wonderful, quite often very conservative and very powerful thinkers who were really questioning, you know, how far down the road do we want to go with high energy spending with fossil fuels and the employment of billions of energy slaves? And what kind of effect is that going to have on us as a people, as a culture, as a community, on our families, on our governments, on how we go about living day to day?
And so what do you look at in the book in terms of the suggestions that could happen in terms of meeting these challenges? Do you think we should use energy more wisely, say? Should we conserve, or do we look to alternatives to oil?
Well, I think we have to do a whole bunch of things, and I think fundamentally we're going to have to learn how to live with less. And the good news there is that people who live with less energy in their lives tend to be much happier. And for a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, because their lives aren't quite as complicated, their lives aren't as frantic, their lives aren't dictated about the purchase of cheap stuff that you cannot really afford or don't need. Their lives are driven more by human energy, the energy of families, the energy of communities. And so that's the really good news. Learning how to live with less energy and fewer energy slaves in your household won't be easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been on a joyride, and we've gone up the energy ladder, climbed it at a rapid pace. Generally speaking, we've always thought we've had one hell of a good time doing so, because simply by not even wanting to discuss some of the moral and philosophical problems one encounters as one goes higher up anything, and we didn't even want to discuss the complexity associated with all of this. So coming down the energy ladder is not going to be simple as switching to renewables.
Yeah.
There are just as many limits and costs and sacrifices associated with renewables and alternatives as there are with fossil fuels. And I agree very much with the economist Jeff Rubin, who says that the new green is really consuming less. less fossil fuels, less stuff generated by our energy slaves, and beginning to look at life in a different way. So you know, the focus of one's life then is not about quantity of stuff, but it's about the quality. The focus of one's life is no longer about the speed, but it is actually about slowing down. The focus of one's life is not being totally distracted all the time by the complexity of and demands of the energy slaves in our household, but being more present and more engaged and using our human energies in a much more vital and focused way.
And do you think that people in our society can get there? I mean,
I think a lot of individuals, a lot of communities, a lot of families are already trying to get there and are on that path. And I'm not convinced that governments and corporations, which are largely the product of high energy spending over the last 100 years, get this at all, or will be the first to make changes. They won't. They'll be the last. And in fact, I'm fairly well convinced at this point in time that, you know, the dominant energy institutions and the people that control them and the people that make money from them will fight tooth and nail any sort of change. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're committed to high energy spending. That's what they understand. That's where their money comes from, and they will put every obstacle in the way they can to reform or change. But meanwhile, ordinary people are beginning to think differently. You know, they want to eat food that is produced locally. They want to focus on the quality of that food. They want to eat it slowly. They want to be able to laugh with everyone at the dinner table once again, and not to gulp everything down. And they are deeply concerned about how high energy spending has changed the metabolism of everything, from our physical metabolism to right down to you know, the quality of our thinking, and the quality of our living. So, you know, just based on what I've you know, the kind of comments and I've gotten from people while on book tour, mm-hmm. there's a real hunger and a real appetite for, okay, so where do we go? What kind of ideas do we need to put in our backpacks? And how can we as individuals start doing this? And I remind them that the abolition movement in the 18th century was essentially started by 14 people in one room who met and together one day and said, you know what, this servitude, this form of servitude must end. And it was a faith-based movement drawn largely from Quakers and Anglicans. It was an odd assortment of people who then worked together and created a social movement unlike anything we've seen on the planet. And I think we are already beginning to see that same sort of social movement stirring right across the globe and in many different forms and guises. And where it's all going to go is, I mean, it's unpredictable, it's uncertain, but it has begun.
Yeah, and you're generally hopeful, though, right?
I'm generally hopeful. I mean, I'm a father, and I have three sons, and so I cannot afford despair. And which is not to say that I'm suggesting, and I'm not a utopian either. I'm a small C conservative, and I don't see life in terms of, you know, ever progressions of greater happiness or greater joy or greater stuff. That's not how I see the world at all. So I think we are in for some very difficult, tough times. And but I'm hopeful about the ability of individuals and communities to make the changes they need to become more resilient and less vulnerable to the storms ahead.
Now, as an aside here, when we're arranging this interview with your publisher, they mentioned that you wouldn't have a cell phone today, and so that if I needed to contact you, I would have to go through someone else. Is that something? Is that like a small change in your life that you're doing?
Well, I've never owned a cell phone, yeah. And I try to limit the number of energy slaves in my life. The energy slave I'm most fond of is my chainsaw, and you know. But I consciously have tried to limit the amount of gadgets and stuff that we, you know, that just seems to stick to us like lint these days, you know. And and so my choice not to have a cell phone is basically I'm saying, look, I'm not going to be a slave to this machine, and people will not be able to reach me any time of the day or night whenever they want to.
Yeah.
And although my sons have cell phones, that's one of the many choices that we can make to limit the amount of energy we consume. And I know most young people have no idea how high energy spending is embedded in each and every digital gadget they purchase. It's extraordinary how much energy it takes to make the microchips and the compressors to run these small machines, and how the introductions of these gadgets to each and every household has driven up energy consumption dramatically in the last 20 years. You know, I think there are decisions we can all make about, well, which energy slaves don't we want to have? You know, certainly getting rid of a car is another great thing to do, walking more. I mean, there are just so many different things we can do in all sorts of levels. Taking out of your kitchen half of all the gadgets there, everything from waffle irons to whatever else, that, you know, maybe you don't need all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you only need just one. And maybe you should focus on the quality of what you have and not the quantity.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you have three sons. I'm assuming that they're young people.
Yes, they are.
Do they get the message that their dad's talking about on all these books that he's writing?
Well, they're all three of them are university students at this point in time, and yes, I think they do get it. And it was a great pleasure to have one of my sons come out to a talk in Victoria, and another one in Squamish, and they do get it, and they know that their lives are going to be fundamentally different in the future, and that there won't be as much cheap energy around. And they've all got the message, and the greatest message I think a father can give to any son is to use your own human energy wisely and put it to good use. When you're a young man, I mean, your energy and your ability to do stuff is rich and precious, and use it wisely, yeah.
I've been reading you for years, Andrew, and so it's been really good speaking today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Joe.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Energy of Slaves, Oil and the New Servitude. It's published by Greystone in partnership with the David Suzuki Foundation. AndrewNikiforuk.com is the website. Andrew Nikiforuk on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.